Behavioral Health Integrations podcast strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minig.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining me for another episode of Behavior Health Integration. Today, we have a very special guest, Dr. Sam Koh. Sam is a physician from California. Sam is a ER physician specializing in ketamine-assisted therapy. Throughout this episode, Sam will get into why he became a medical doctor in the first place, his process in doing that. Sam will also discuss his main motivations for, again, getting into ketamine-assisted therapy. And Sam will discuss his own ketamine practice and what his facility does when it comes to policies and procedures as it comes to screening patients for ketamine-assisted therapy to see if they qualify for treatment or not. Sam will also get into the many possible benefits ketamine can have on someone as it comes to their mental health and so much more. So without further ado, let's get started. Well, Sam, thank you so much again for being on the show, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's an honor to be here, Jacob. Really appreciate you inviting me to come on to your show.
Absolutely. So you're on the West Coast right now, right?
I am in Palm Springs, California. Oh. So it's SoCal classic. Right now I'm looking out the window. It's sunny and hot and no clouds in the sky today.
Yeah, up in Minnesota here, we're probably at, mid-60s, so that's not horrible.
Yeah, awesome. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've never really been to California. I've always wanted to visit, you know.
It's amazing. That's one of, when I was here out in, back in, what was it? I had just finished medical school. Or actually, I was in my fourth year of med school, and I was interviewing at all these different positions for residency. And when I came to California in December versus December in upstate New York, it was just a drastic difference. And so I just fell in love with being in the sun, just these nice, amazing winters. And that's, you know, one of the things that inspired me to come here.
I was just going to say, do you guys even get winters there?
We do, but it's like, probably the best winters in the world. It's, I don't know, maybe highs of 70s and lows of 50s or 40s. But yeah, the winters, fall, winters, and spring are amazing in Palm Springs. But of course, there is a downside because in the summers, it can get pretty brutal. So I'm talking like 110, 115. And then even like in the night, it'll stay like in the upper 90s sometimes.
Okay.
So it can get pretty insane.
See, I have been to Vegas, but that's like the farthest West Coast I've ever been. But I absolutely love dry heat. But like you said, at the same time, 115 is 115. It's hot.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. It is toasty. And we actually get a lot of people who leave during the summer. And then, you know, they're like from Canada or Michigan or New York. And then they'll, you know, come back to the Palm Springs area, probably like September, October, November. That's when it starts cooling down a bit.
Okay. So I forgot to ask you, where did you grow up?
I kind of grew up all over the place. Cool. So actually, I was born in Seoul, South Korea.
Oh, wow.
And my family, my parents immigrated to the United States. I think I was like 3 years old. And so I've lived in Oklahoma. That was where my dad was getting his PhD in chemistry. Oh, then wow. I lived in Texas, Florida, Idaho, Seattle, Washington, New York, California. So I've kind of like from all over and have experienced, you know, both international and domestic living situations.
Was that more just to his job? Like that's why you guys had to keep moving?
Yeah, it was mainly his job, his education, and those were the big things. And then I went to college in Seattle, Washington. And so I was there for, you know, a good 4 years. Mm-hmm. And then medical school in University of Rochester, which is in upstate New York. So that was when you know, I experienced some extreme cold temperatures. They have lake effect snow.
Yep.
From Lake Ontario, which you may or may not be familiar with. But then, yeah, just I've been living in Southern California for the past, let's see, so 2008. So yeah, like how many years is that? Yeah, 14 years roughly.
Okay.
So this is what I consider home now.
So I have to ask you, what really inspired you to want to go to med school and be a doctor?
That's a really good question. So, you know, when I was growing up, the sciences and just schoolwork came really easily for me. And it was just a natural fit. And because my parents were, you know, they immigrated, I don't know if you've had other guests, but when people come from a different country to the United States, there's kind of this like expectation to do, you know, become a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer. So there was definitely some parental influence. But I remember when I was in high school, I was taking a class. It was called like health and human sciences. It was like just like an introduction to health. And I remember in that class, like it was just really easy for me. And I was scoring like 98, 99%.
Yeah.
And the teacher of that class was actually a retired nurse.
Oh, wow.
And she had wrote this letter of recommendation for me to attend a pre-med medical scholar program through University of Washington. So she's like, hey, Sam, I think you're going to, you know, do a great job in this area. So she recommended, had a great experience with that. And then when I started school in college, I was pre-med. And what's interesting is with pre-med, a lot of people start college pre-med.
Yep.
But then they're like, nah, that's not for me. It's not for me. And the pre-medical process, it's pretty rigorous. So there's like general chemistry, biology, biochemistry, organic chemistry, physics, et cetera, et cetera. And those classes really do screening, right? So though if someone weed doesn't out. Do well, like, yeah, it's like the weed out. And for me, I don't know. It was just like, not easy, but it wasn't that difficult for me. Like I was just able to, you know, for example, like organic chemistry, I remember doing really well in organic chemistry. And I remember doing really well in, you know, general chemistry and biology, et cetera. So it was just like a natural fit. So I didn't get weeded out during the process. And then of course I gained experience. I was doing volunteer work in college, volunteering at a level one trauma center up in Seattle, Washington, doing some lab work at University of Washington. So there was just a lot of like serendipities that said, hey, you're on the right path. And ultimately, you know, got into med school, got into residency, and now I am practicing medicine.
It's kind of an offhanded question, but I listen to like a lot of med school podcasts. It's just an interest of mine, just the process you're just talking about. Do you, this is a weird question, do you feel bad for like all the students who want to be doctors, but they just can't quite handle the intense workload like you just mentioned? Because there's just so many like dramatic stories about like people crying, and I've tried so hard to be a doctor, but I couldn't pass biochem, but they love it and so forth. Like,
yeah, I feel like if someone really, really, really wants to do it, even if they fail biochem or don't do well in their undergrad, like they can still get into medical school, maybe not in the United States. So for example, they might go to, you know,
Caribbean.
Like, yeah, a Caribbean med school, or they may go to a different country. So if someone is like, hey, I'm going to do this no matter what my scores were like they're going to make it happen. And then, you know, if they meet that obstacle and they're like, hey, you know what, actually, it's not worth it. I'm actually going to become a, you know, PA or a nurse or a nurse practitioner. Like there's still opportunities to make an impact in healthcare. It doesn't have to be, you know, either in a, you know, medical degree.
It's funny, not to get too off track, but I listened to this guy, Dave Ramsey. I don't know if you ever heard of him.
Yeah, I have.
The saddest, one of the saddest stories I ever heard was a guy calling in, and I think he got through his second year of like medical school, but there's these like big exams towards the end of medical school where if you don't pass, you can't go on for residency, like the UMSL or whatever.
Yeah, it stands for the United States Medical Licensing Exam, USMLE. And there's actually three phases to the USMLE. And so the first one is called Step One. And you take that typically after your second year of medical school.
Okay.
And that's a big test. So the score of it will determine what specialties you're likely to be able to match into or get a spot into. So yeah,
Okay.
and that one's a really tough one. It's a lot of work, a lot of memorization. But what's interesting is that, even to go to medical school, you have to take the MCATs, the medical college admission test. So if someone doesn't do well on the MCATs, then they probably won't do too well on the step one. But conversely, if someone does really well on the MCATs, then they're probably going to do really well on step one. So it's kind of like a whole process, because you have, the SATs, ACTs, MCATs, LSATs, step one, step two, step three. And so for me, I got really good at taking tests. And now, I still take tests every, 10 years. I have to do my board exams. And so that's another like 4 to 6 hour test. So at the end of the day, someone has to, who's interested in entering this profession, like, you either have to get really good at tests or you're going to get really good at tests.
And like you said, you are, I guess, one of those students where you can just sit in the classroom and retain information really easily. Is that right? An
It
extent?
was much easier in high school,
Okay.
but definitely in college and med school, like, I had to study a lot. And I remember, like, back in med school, I was, it was a Friday night, Saturday night, and guess what I'm doing? I'm studying. I'm at a, back in the days, there's Barnes and Noble, that for some reason that was a really popular place that we'd study at. And so I remember going to Barnes and Noble and just, I'm studying there till they close. And that's all I did was study, study, study. Just that was my life back then.
And you have the work ethic. That's awesome.
And I think it's in a way beneficial because residency is really hard. Right, we're working 80 plus hours a week sometimes, and it's kind of like a screening process. So if someone isn't able to, have that work ethic, then you're going to get screened out, and it's incredibly challenging. So I feel like it builds resilience by doing these harder things. It's kind of like lifting weights, right? So you start with the 5 pound weight, and then the 10 pound weight, and then before you know it, you're lifting 100 pounds. But each step of the process is adding that extra weight.
Oh, absolutely. But the horrendously sad story about this guy, now that I remember more, I think he was on his fourth year. But I don't want to say that it was an excuse, but he just kept saying, "I just don't remember the first 2 years of like medical school information." So I think he was allowed to take the test three times, maybe, and he failed every time. And med school is like, "Okay, you're done. You're
I
done."
think they do. I think they do set a limit on the number of attempts you can have on that test.
So he has all that student loan now and no MD.
So, well, technically, you can still graduate from medical school and get an MD, but you won't necessarily be licensed. So I actually know physicians, well, they're doctors, they're MDs, and they didn't take step one, step two, step three, or not all of them. And then they're doing something, whether it's like, hey, I'm going to become a consultant, or I'm going to get into investing, or I'm going to start up a biotech company. So you can still leverage the MD even without necessarily becoming licensed.
That's really
And
cool.
so there's options for sure.
And speaking of options and transition, so you're going through your residency, right? And you decide to choose emergency medicine. What about emergency medicine really intrigued you?
So I had mentioned in college I was doing some volunteer work, and the place I was volunteering at was an ER. So when I went to the hospital, they're like, hey, do you want to volunteer in the oncology unit and the palliative care in ER? And I was like, oh, I guess I'll do ER. It seems like it's going to be the most versatile. I'll be exposed to a lot of different specialties. I'll see some things. And so I spent, I think, my junior and senior year of college, once a week going to the ER on a Friday afternoon and just seeing all sorts of stuff. And what was so funny, Jacob, was that when I was volunteering in the ER, I told myself, man, I could never do this job. I would never do this. And then when I entered med school, so with med school, classically, the first 2 years are like, quote, book work. And then the latter 2 years are more clinical work. And when I entered that, the latter 2 years, I actually enjoyed every specialty. Like I was like, hey, neurology is cool. Internal medicine is cool. Surgery is cool. Orthopedics is cool. Psychiatry, this is, interesting. So I liked all the specialties. And when I started my 4th year of med school, that's when I did a rotation in the ER. And it just felt really natural to me. Like kind of the example I would give is, if you've been hanging out in a swimming pool for quite a bit of time and then you step out of the swimming pool and then you come back in and you know how it just feels right. When I walked into the ER, it was hectic. There's sirens going off and there's people yelling and there's this machine that's beeping. And for, one person, they may say, oh yeah, this is intense. But for me, it just felt really like a good fit. And I said, hey, this is my specialty. And it was really based upon like how it made me feel and my intuition.
Absolutely. So you did a couple of years of that as a residency, or how does that work?
Yeah, so after medical school, then the students, we select our specialty, which might be, for me it was emergency medicine. So I came down to Southern California and did 3 years of emergency medicine training. So that's from back in 2008 to 2011. It was intense. It was hard. And
But you're still getting paid, right? You're finally getting paid some salary now.
yeah, so residents, they get paid. I mean, if you boil it down to the like hours worked, it's probably, slightly right around minimum wage. But yeah, we are getting paid. And I think the average med student, I think the median loan amount is like 240,000 because med school these days, it's pretty expensive. So, but yeah, during residency training. And so that can be, depending upon which specialty, 3 years long, 4 years long, 5 years long, 7 years long. I know it's pretty intense. And then, of course, after residency, then you can do something called fellowship, which is an additional 1, 2, 3 years, depending upon what fellowship one chooses.
Do you feel like that's something that's wrong in the medical system where residents should be treated better as to more pay than for what they do? Because that doesn't seem fair in extent. Like you guys are working like 60 plus hours a week and getting paid probably at the time 6, 7 bucks an hour. I don't know,
Yeah, I know there's some
That's brutal.
definitely there's like unions that are forming where residents are saying, hey, we actually need to get paid, a better rate. And, we also want certain, benefits, et cetera. So I think it's changing. But yeah, I feel like the process is very intense. It's very long. And there's pros and cons. Like, unfortunately, in residency, like I've been hearing more about this, but there's been suicides and high rates of depression and anxiety and PTSD. And I would attribute it to the fact of, having a work-life balance.
Did you know
And
anybody personally? And you don't need to give out names, but did you work with anybody that was going through any type of depression or anxiety or burnout?
oh, yeah,
You
absolutely.
saw it?
Yeah, absolutely. And unfortunately, I've also, not super close, but there's also been people that are in the community where they've died by suicide. And it's incredibly challenging. And yeah, this is kind of one of the things that a lot of people may not know, but I think there's estimates like 300 to 400 doctors die by suicide per year. So that's like an entire medical school. And it's they have higher rates of substance abuse, they have higher rates of suicide, they have higher rates of, probably mood disorders. And a lot of that isn't discussed because, there's kind of a mental health stigma for physicians seeking mental health.
Was it more of the mentality you have to tough it out because the old time doctors did it, so now you guys have to do it type thing?
Yeah, there's a bit of that for sure. And then with like licensing. So once you finish your medical degree, then you have to get licensed. And one of those questions that's asked on the licensing is like, hey, have you ever sought help for mental health?
Oh, sh
And then
okay.
if you click yes on that little checkbox, then of course you have to, you know, do an essay, you know, explain, well, explain more if you click yes. And so there are some state medical boards that are saying, hey, we should get rid of this because it's really affecting doctors seeking out professional help because they don't have that stigma. So I feel like it's changing, but yeah, there is definitely like a trend, a historical trend of not wanting to, you know, discuss that issue.
Yeah. 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 Same thing when it comes to mental health clinicians too, because it's more of the fear of how your colleagues are going to look at you now or your superiors, where if you admit, hey, I got an addiction or I need help, get my profession, I'm supposed to be helping people. And what's that going to do for my, like my job in the future, my job outlook, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting. It's really interesting how that happens. And it's sad. It's sad. And I think we definitely need to change that. And at my clinic, I've actually treated, you know, physicians and therapists and nurses. So definitely making some inroads there.
That's awesome, man. So now the big question, what intrigued you to ketamine and ketamine assisted therapy?
Yeah, so that's a great question because, you know, I look back upon my life and I see all of these like synchronistic connections. Mm-hmm. So I think Steve Jobs has this, he was giving a talk at Stanford for a commencement speech, and he was mentioning how, you know, he couldn't tell when he was in it, mm-hmm. how it would lead to Apple. But now looking backwards, he can see how the things, the certain events aligned. So for example, like for me, I look back upon my life and I'm like, oh, that makes sense. Like, for example, when I was a research assistant in college, one of the medications that I was administering was ketamine. Mm-hmm. And I was using it for in an animal research setting, but I was administering ketamine. And then if you think about which specialties use ketamine, it's mainly emergency medicine and anesthesia. That's where we get the most amount of residency training of, you know, how do I use it safely and how do I monitor, et cetera, for procedural sedation or operating room use. So there's another point for ketamine. And then when I was working in the ER, I saw a lot of patients with psychiatric challenges. Yeah. And so, for example, if someone is having a severe depressive episode or severe suicidal ideation, guess where they'll go? To the emergency department. Yeah. And so I was seeing a lot of these patients. And because there was a, and there is a lack of mental health support, they would probably sit in the ER waiting to go to a psychiatric facility. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes they would sit there for 24 hours or 48 hours or 72 hours, just waiting for a psychiatric bed. Mm-hmm. And that was when I came across the first research study looking at ketamine. So it was published in 2000. By a psychiatrist named Dr. Berman and his colleagues, where they were administering IV ketamine. It was a really small study, but they were comparing IV ketamine versus placebo. So just saline, basically, over a 40-minute period. And what they found was a dramatic drop in their depression scores in the ketamine group. And so I started reading into the science behind the ketamine and the evidence. And I was like, this is really interesting. Like, mm-hmm. hey, maybe we can do something in the emergency department to help these, all these psychiatric patients that are having, you know, their struggles. But you know, the medicine is kind of slow to change. And so at a certain point I'm like, you know what, this is something that I'm personally really excited about. And, I love also getting results fast. That's one of the nice things about emergency medicine is sometimes there are some patients, they can come in, we can, you know, fix their broken bone or pop in back that dislocated shoulder, or, you know, they have some sort of irregular cardiac rhythm and we can fix it. And I loved that type of experience where we can make a, you know, rapid impact. And I felt the same way with ketamine, where we can make a rapid impact, maybe not, you know, in a couple hours, but over a period of like 1, 2, 3 weeks, like we can make a huge impact. Yeah. And that is personally just incredibly gratifying, especially for those patients who have been struggling for years. Yeah. And it's like, wow, we can turn them around. Of course, it's not every single patient, but the patients who do benefit, I really like seeing those dramatic improvements.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. So for my listeners' sake, could you give them maybe the basic definition of what ketamine actually is and what it does?
Yeah, so ketamine is a dissociative anesthetic. It was invented in the 1960s by Parke Davis Pharmaceutical Company. They were looking for a medication that could be used safely for anesthetic procedures. And what's really interesting is ketamine is a derivative of another medication called phencyclidine. And so phencyclidine was also invented by Parke Davis Pharmaceuticals, also intended to be a general anesthetic, but it had all of these side effects. So ultimately, they asked a organic chemist out of Wayne State University. His name is Dr. Calvin Stevens. And so they consulted with Dr. Calvin Stevens and said, "Hey, can you make a safer drug than this phencyclidine that we have?" And so he came up with ketamine and tested it. And ultimately, he found, yeah, this is really remarkable. It's a great anesthetic. And in 1970, that's when it was FDA approved for use as a general anesthetic in diagnostic procedures. So mainly, in the operating room. And how it works, one of the main mechanisms of action, and for those listeners who are familiar, it's works on the N-methyl D aspartate. So I'm just going to shorten that down, NMDA receptors in the brain. And it's mainly affecting a neurotransmitter called glutamate. And what is interesting about glutamate is that glutamate consists of 90% of the neurotransmitters in our brain. So, we have the other ones, serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, et cetera. Those only comprise a small percentage, but glutamate is one of the main neurotransmitters. And so ketamine is mainly working on that. Now, ketamine also has indirect effects on cannabinoid receptors, opioid receptors, a bunch of other receptors. So it's not necessarily like one single mechanism of action, but that's the NMDA receptor blockage is kind of the main one that it's most familiar for.
Now, does it also get like a bad like stereotype or a negative stereotype? Because it I think it used to be called Special K, right? Used as a party drug.
Yeah, that's one of the most common misconceptions that I face as a ketamine specialist is, ketamine does have a history of abuse. And, and it was mainly popular, I think, more in like the maybe the European countries, maybe more of the Asian countries, not as, popular in the United States, but it was still used as a drug of abuse. And, people were using it as in a club setting and even probably now. So yeah, it has that reputation as being quote Special K. It also has a reputation as being a horse tranquilizer, a cat tranquilizer. But it is true, it has been used on animals. So, veterinarians use it. But what a lot of people may not know is that ketamine is one of the most commonly used medications worldwide for sedation. And the World Health Organization has it on one of its most essential medications that a healthcare system should have. And it's used ubiquitously through the ER and the OR. It's probably, as you're listening to this, someone is receiving ketamine in a medical setting. So I would say it does have that history, but the vast majority of it is used in a medical setting. Of course, there is abuse of it as well.
And do you feel like there's a huge misconception that it's put in the category of like psychedelics at times when it's not?
Yeah, so ketamine, so it depends upon how you define psychedelics. So there's like classical psychedelics,
LSD,
which
MDMA.
are so classical psychedelics refers to drugs that affect the serotonin system. So LSD would be one, psilocybin, DMT, and then you have the other non-classical psychedelics, which would be like MDMA. MDMA is actually a methamphetamine based medication, and then ketamine is a dissociative anesthetic. So, but if you think about the word psychedelic, and I don't know, do you know what the root of psychedelic is?
No.
So if you break it down into psych, and delic. So psych referring to the mind, and then delic referring to manifesting. So mind manifesting. So I would consider it not a classical psychedelic, but definitely with psychedelic effects.
Okay. And so when you're working with clients, you don't necessarily want them to have that psychedelic feeling when taking ketamine.
I have a different approach to that. Yeah. And I think a lot of other ketamine clinic owners do as well. So it's a feature, not a bug, where, you know, potentially having those psychedelic, or I'm going to use the word dissociative effects, can be more beneficial. And there are some studies looking at this that were that when they administered ketamine, the more dissociation that the patient had, the more robust the antidepressant effects were. In addition, some of the experiences that a patient can have can be quite spiritual or mystical. Nice. So they may feel like, hey, I'm having an out-of-body experience, or they may feel like they're seeing, you know, deceased relatives, or they may feel like they're floating in outer space, or even kind of like a near-death type experience. And at the end of the day, when someone has that type of experience, it can be scary. So not every situation can be, it can be scary, but a lot of times if they can work through that, then it can be incredibly profound.
So if they, you know, once they get through it, yes, it's like a nightmare, but when they come down, they gain so much from that experience.
Yeah. And I would say the majority of people probably wouldn't have nightmares. So there's something called this concept called set and setting, which you or your listeners may be familiar with. But for those who are not, set referring to the mindset. Okay. And then setting referring to the environment where one receives ketamine. So what's the patient's mindset? What's the environment they're receiving it? So one example would be when I was working in the ER, and the ER is a pretty intense place for those of you who've been there, where there's, you know, as I'd mentioned, there's people yelling and there's hustling and bustling and noises and beeping. Now, I don't think that would be a really optimal setting to receive IV ketamine for a pain disorder or a mood disorder, right? Because I did administer it once, and a patient experienced like they were in hell, and they were like in the depths of hell, and they were freaking out. And fortunately, we were able to calm them down, give them some IV benzodiazepine. Now, in my clinic setting, it's very calm. It's very mellow. It's very tranquil. You know, it smells good. It, you know, there's paintings that are, you know, really pleasing, and there's music that's really therapeutic. So all of these factors play a role into the setting. And then, of course, we have our patients prepare their mindset. And so, for example, you know, if someone, I remember we had a patient who then, you know, maybe 3 or 4 days watched some horror movie. And that also impacted his experience, where he started seeing some, you know, horrific things. But if the patient is prepared, and, you know, we have like a whole list of preparation that we recommend for our patients, you know, avoiding these horror movies or zombie video games, maybe taking some time off of social media, news, et cetera, other meditative journaling practices, changing their diet, exercise, nature, et cetera, et cetera. If they prepare the mindset before the ketamine infusion, it can actually lead to quite a profound mystical transformative experience.
That's beautiful. That's really awesome. And I have another question too, for like the screening process. Does it play a big role? Let's say if they're on other prescription medications like antidepressants, Adderall, anti-anxiety medications, like would that still be okay to go about ketamine therapy? Are there any medications that may play a negative role in that in combining the two?
Yeah, great question. So there's two medications that we know that will decrease the effectiveness of ketamine therapy. And those two medications are, number one, lamotrigine, aka Lamictal. And there are some studies that show that it attenuates the response for ketamine therapy. And then the second one are benzodiazepines. Okay. So benzodiazepines includes like lorazepam or clonazepam or Valium or, you know, Xanax, Ativan, et cetera, would be more of the common. So those two medications can decrease the effectiveness of IV ketamine. But we've seen with SSRIs, SNRIs, atypical antidepressants, like those can still be used and the patient can take those during the ketamine therapy.
So, you know, it's funny. I have another question too about my past episodes when I've interviewed people based on psychedelics assisted therapy, and the people usually giving the treatments, they say that, again, for psychedelics, that can mean many different things like ayahuasca, LSD, or whatnot, that they need to be completely off any type of antipsychotics or anti-anxiety or antidepressants because of the effects on the brain.
Yeah. So, with
and
like,
I just think, I think that's kind of, I don't know, I'm not a doctor, but I would worry about someone being off their antidepressants for a period of time, just in general, before taking psychedelics.
Yeah. So, well, one of the biggest concerns with like the classical psychedelics, remember I had mentioned the classical ones typically refer to the ones affecting the serotonin system. Mm-hmm. So there's a dangerous syndrome. It's called serotonin syndrome. And mm-hmm. it's basically where the body overdoses on serotonin. So if someone is mm-hmm. on an SSRI and now they're taking a substance that is going to increase or affect the serotonin levels, then they could have a, you know, very serious condition called serotonin syndrome. So that's another one. And then also there's like the whole tyramine effect, because I believe with ayahuasca, it also includes like an MAOI inhibitor. So there's definitely interactions with different substances. So at the end of the day, I'm sure you're going to have like a little disclaimer, but talk with a professional, right? Talk with your doctor, talk with your ketamine specialist before, you know, venturing onto this space, because it's not something you want to, I mean, your mind is really important. Your brain is really important. Don't want you to play Dr. Google, like talk with a trained healthcare professional who's familiar with this for sure to discuss the intricacies of medications, because pharmacology, you know, literally we spend a lot of time studying pharmacology, and it's not something you just want to try to figure out on your own.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I also see now you also have your MBA.
Yeah. So when I was in med school, there was this great option where instead of doing just 4 years of med school, I could tack on an extra year and get a master's in business administration. And so I had a really, really good time doing that. It was actually a lot of fun. I guess, you know, kind of in my familial background, you know, there's entrepreneurs and business owners. And so I just always loved that kind of aspect. And I also like being the captain of my own ship. I have a hard time, to be honest, like working for other people.
Yep.
And that's one of the reasons I became a doctor. I'm like, cool, I'm going to become a doctor. I can be the captain of my ship. I can make my own decisions. But what I found is that in medicine, especially today, the vast majority of physicians are employees of a large healthcare system. Now, maybe probably 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, doctors were not that way, where they had their own practice or they had their own clinic or, you know, hospital, et cetera. But now it's transitioning more to corporate practice of medicine, where doctors are now employees and there was, you know, there's some manager above them. So when I got into medicine, I was like, oh yeah, that just doesn't feel right for me. And I really prefer to do my own thing, make my own decisions. I'm not a real big fan of being in meetings for hours at a time discussing a change that's going to happen in 3 to 6 months. Like, no, I like making decisions and executing.
And are you doing a webinar, or have you done a webinar on starting your own ketamine clinic with doctors yet?
Yeah, you definitely did your research, Jacob.
I did. So, a little
bit. What happened was, so we opened up the Reset Ketamine in Palm Springs back in 2018.
And that's your own facility, right?
It's our own facility. It's your baby. My own medical clinic. It's my baby. And then I started getting other physicians who are like, hey, Sam, like, how do I do this? Like, what are you doing? How do I do it? So I was like fielding phone calls from all these physicians nationwide, like, hey, what do I need to do? You know, what do I need to buy? And how do I, I was just talking with a lot of people, and I'm like, hell, maybe I should make a course and just teach other physicians on how to start up their own practices. So yeah, for any physicians who are listening, who are interested, they can check out ketaminestartup.com. It's actually my wife and I, she's also a physician, and we've kind of partnered up in creating that course because she played a really big role in starting up Reset Ketamine as well. So yeah, we've helped seven other ketamine clinics open up nationwide with that course, and it's rewarding because we're able to impact not only physicians who start up their own clinics, but then I think about, oh, the impact that the physicians are going to make upon their patients. And then once they impact their patients, well, what's the impact that that patient's going to make in their friends and family circle? And so it's kind of like this butterfly ripple effect that is really inspirational to me.
So would you say your MBA really helped you develop the skills to run your own business, or could someone very easily just learn that on their own type thing?
That's a really good question. And I get that question frequently asked from other doctors who are like, hey, why don't I start up my own clinic? Do I need to have an MBA? I would say no, you don't need to, because if someone is able to make it through grad school, med school, residency, all of that training, then they can definitely pick up the skills. But for me, I'm a learner. I remember in med school, they said, hey, 50% of what we teach you is going to be wrong. And we just don't know what that 50% is. So what that means is everyone in class needs to become lifelong learners. So no matter how old, how many years, you've been out of your training, like continue learning. So I just have a personal passion for learning, and I think people should learn what they're personally just passionate about and interested in. And so for me, that was that whole business side. Like I really loved learning about marketing and finance and strategy and negotiation and business plans and entrepreneurship. That was, just really interesting to me. So yeah, but I do find it incredibly useful. But I wouldn't say it's absolutely required to start up your own practice.
Little side question. Could a therapist like myself, or let's say a psychologist, do the same thing, even though they're not a medical doctor, but run a ketamine clinic?
Yeah, and we get that question asked a lot too.
Okay.
It depends upon the state.
Okay.
So anyone who's interested, like talk with a business attorney, because each state has various laws about who can open up a medical clinic. So for example, in California state, only physicians can open up medical clinics. Conversely, in Florida, anyone can open up a medical clinic and hire physicians as employees. So, another example, like in Washington state, you don't have to be an MD or a DO to start up a clinic. You can actually be a nurse practitioner or a CRNA. So it's going to be quite variable depending upon the state you live in, because each state sets their own laws and regulations about the medical practices.
Okay, good information. Interesting. Then I got another question too. So we're going back to your facility. I'm kind of more curious about the process, right? So let's say somebody's dealing with some depression, anxiety, or whatnot, and they go in and they fill out the intake paperwork. Now, again, it doesn't mean they're going to get ketamine therapy right away. You gotta really pursue that screening and assessment process, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And
Yeah. So,
do they need, let's say, a DA from a mental health therapist prior to going further with you, or how does that work?
Yeah. So, what the process would look like would be someone would either call us or hop on the website and fill out that, consultation request. Then they would fill out an online intake form going over, hey, these are my medicines, these are my allergies, surgeries, family history, et cetera, the typical medical information. Then we schedule a consultation to see if it's a good fit. But not everyone is a good fit, and that's kind of what that screening initial consultation is for. Now, once that happens, depending upon the patient, we'll either get a psychiatrist to refer them, or we'll review and or review their medical records from their primary MD, psychiatrist, therapist, et cetera. Once all of that is screened, and so pretty much it's not like we do pretty rigorous, strict screening. Other clinics may vary in how they screen, but at our clinic here in Palm Springs, we screen them pretty rigorously because we want it to be safe. So once they pass that and everything, their labs look good and their kidney function and liver, everything is kosher, then we schedule the patients for the infusions. And that could be, 1, 2, 3 weeks from that initial consultation call. We have four stages of ketamine therapy at our clinic. So the first one is preparation. So as I'd mentioned to really preparing the mind. And we have a whole list of guidelines of how do I prepare the mind. And the next stage is the intention. So having a very clear intention or goal of what they're seeking. The third stage is experience. So having that ketamine infusion experience. Mm-hmm. So I don't think the psychedelic effects are something I want to decrease, but I want them to have that experience. Mm-hmm. And we do our best to make sure it's a positive experience. And the last stage is integration. So that's where the person will either talk with a therapist or a psychedelic integration coach, or even personally make their own integration. And that could be, you know, some examples would be like, hey, I want to journal. I want to start meditating. I want to take a break from alcohol. I want to start exercising. Hey, maybe I need to change my job, or they need to take the lessons from their experience and then integrate it into their daily life. I say taking the something from the extraordinary back into the ordinary life of integration.
So what's the time frame between stages or phases 3 and 4? Because the fourth is when they're actually seeing someone and talking to someone. And the third, correct me if I'm wrong, is when they're actually getting the IV treatment.
Yeah. So the third, the experience is when they're getting the IV.
So they're not seeing a therapist in that moment.
No, because we want the person to have an internal experience. So we actually do like eye shades, Bluetooth noise canceling headphones, so that they're having a full on experience with themselves. A lot of our lives, we always been looking outwards.
Yep.
And like, hey, who has the answers? Who has the answers? What? Tell me what to do.
Yeah.
And during the ketamine therapy, I really invite them to close their eyes, go inside, connect with themselves and their higher intuition. And then a day or two later, then they may schedule a session with their therapist to like process it and decompress it.
That's very cool. The reason I asked that is because like some facilities who do psychedelics do it a little differently, where they actually have two therapists during the phase three moment where they're going through the experience while talking to a therapist at the same time. So that's why I was just curious.
Yeah. Yeah. And people will do it differently. I think of ketamine therapy as like kind of the art of medicine, right? Yep. So if I give, you know, Dr. Smith a set of paintbrushes and then I give Dr. Lee a set of paintbrushes, well, guess what? They're going to paint different portraits because this is the art. So yeah, I don't think that necessisely one way is better than the other. I think people, clinicians just do it differently. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, as long as they're doing their best to serve the patient at the highest level, I think it's, you know, totally cool.
Now, do you have any therapist on your staff?
We don't have any therapist, but we do have integration specialists. Hmm. So a lot of our patients already have a mental health counselor, an LMFT, a psychologist. So if they already have one, we say, hey, please continue with them. And if you don't have one, we have a list of local psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists that they can reach out to. And then the third option is we also have an integration coach that we hire as a kind of a independent contractor, and she will also meet with them. And typically it's done virtually, probably a day or two after the sessions.
What does one have to be an integration coach?
So what's interesting with integration coaching is there's no strict like licensing as, you know, like a medical degree or an LMFT. But right now it's pretty open, but there are various integration trainings available, and, you know, some of them are online, some of them are in person. So I think the important thing would be to take one of those courses.
Okay. Interesting. And I'm assuming when a client comes in, they got to sign a release of information with their therapist, right?
Right. With their therapist, psychiatrist, primary MD, we review their medical records.
And then do you do a lot of communication with the therapist or doctors with the client regarding their experiences?
We definitely keep the lines of communication open. Mm-hmm. So for example, if a psychiatrist refers one of their patients to us, then we'll send them a letter after, you know, completing all six initiation series of like, hey, this is how they did. This is what their vital signs look like. This is what their PHQ-9 depression scores, PTSD scores, et cetera. You know, how it changed, and then the updated treatment plans.
So what would you do if you had a client coming in who had a therapist, but the therapist did not approve of your ketamine therapy? Sticky situation. I know, I'm just throwing out sticky situations.
Yeah, but I love it. When we've had that.
Okay.
And I say, okay, and let's have a conversation. So I'll talk with the therapist and say, hey, you know, what are your concerns? And I think a lot of it has to do with education, because there is that stigma like, oh yeah, it's a club drug of abuse. But I always ask the question, like, well, and sometimes I see this with psychiatrists where they're like, oh, no, it's, you know, strange and I don't believe in that. It's like, well, one of the things I personally learned in medical school is something called evidence-based medicine,
Oh, yeah.
EBM, right? And I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Yep.
Well, let's look at the evidence. Let's look at the scientific data. Let's look at the systematic reviews. Let's look at the meta-analyses. And then I think if someone is open-minded, they're like, okay, let me check out those articles. And so when we're able to educate people about it, and you know, I feel like this podcast that we're doing is a part of that education, is just letting people know, like, yeah, there's scientific data, there's randomized, double-blinded, placebo-controlled trials, and that's what I was taught in med school. So, as I'd mentioned earlier, 50% of everything that we're taught is wrong. We don't know what that 50% is. Thus, each clinician needs to stay on top of the data. They need to read the latest, you know, scientific articles. And if they are able to do that and they're open-minded, I feel like the best clinicians would be willing to change their mind. Now, of course, some people get stuck and they're rigid. There's this
Can I
old...
say ego? Is ego a powerful thing?
Yeah, ego is a powerful thing. But, you know, sometimes people get stuck in their mental mindset. And I remember hearing this quote that medicine changes one funeral at a time. So, you know, once a physician gets stuck in a certain way, sometimes like it's really, really hard to change their mind. And it's not just with like psychiatry, you know, sometimes with like cardiology, like, you know, a doctor's like, I've always used this blood pressure medicine. I don't care what anything says. I'm just going to stick with this. Or I've always used this antibiotic and I don't care what the other, you know, evidence shows. So it does happen because, you know, doctors are human.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm also curious too. So in the phase three moment, when you're giving the client the IV, is that usually half an hour long process or an hour? How does that work?
Yeah, it's based upon the evidence. So the scientific studies that were done looking at this, they typically did like a 40-minute infusion.
Okay.
And the dose will vary, but classically 0.5 milligrams per kilogram. And then we'll titrate that dose to the patient effect. So, you know, we don't want to be too low on the ketamine, but we don't want to be too high on the ketamine dose either. There's kind of a Goldilocks amount that we do our best at our clinic to like custom tailor for each patient.
So it's based mostly on the size of the patient?
Initially, but then also once we talk with them. So once the ketamine infusion is over, we'll actually have like a debriefing session with the patient to see, you know, how, what was the effect like? We'll also review all of their vital signs. One of the things that we do at our clinic is continuous vital sign monitoring. So we're looking at their oxygen levels, their cardiac rhythm, blood pressure, heart rate, respiratory rate, continuously. And then we also talk with the patient after to see what their effect was. And then based upon that, so it's not only their body size, but it's also the vital signs in conjunction with the patient's experience.
Okay. And then after that, how long do they keep doing the therapy? Is it like once a week for 3 months, 4 months? How does that work?
Yeah, so there's like two phases. There's the initiation, which is the classic six sessions done over a period of 2 to 3 weeks, sometimes 4 weeks. And then there's maintenance. So after they get that initiation, then there's maintenance. And so the maintenance could be every 4 weeks, every 5 weeks, every 6 weeks, every 8 weeks, once every 3 months. It kind of depends upon the patient's symptoms. And then other patients, they're like, you know, actually, I don't need any maintenance for now. And then they might come back 6 months from now or a year from now. Or I've had patients who are like, you know, solid for 2 years. And I'm like, wow, it's been 2 years since we last saw you. And they're like, yeah, I feel like, you know, I need a booster.
Okay. You know, I wonder what the research is like compared to, let's say you take antidepressants versus ketamine assisted therapy, on like how much better is ketamine than antidepressants and so forth. You know what I'm talking about? Right.
Yeah. And there's really no direct head-to-head comparisons. Ketamine is a generic medication. So it was FDA approved in 1970. And so for research funding, a lot of it comes from pharmaceutical companies, and pharmaceutical companies want to have patents and, you know, make money from their newest, latest drugs. So they're willing to invest money into new novel drugs, but if it's a generic drug, that's a bit more challenging.
Okay. Okay. Now, going back to an earlier question too, let's say you have a patient that does not quite qualify for the ketamine-assisted therapy. Do you have any alternative therapies that you give them instead?
So I specialize in ketamine infusions, but so I personally don't offer them other medications or therapies, but I say, hey, talk with your psychiatrist or talk with your therapist, because ketamine is just one tool, right? And so it's, I think of like Batman, and it's just like, hey, this is just one tool, but there's 100 tools. There might be TMS, it might be ECT, it might be CBT, it might be EMDR, it might be acupuncture, it might be functional medicine. So there's a host of options out there, and ketamine is just one of those options. So I'm not, one of those people who are like, hey, this is the only thing you can do and everything else is wrong. It's like, no, like, let's open up our minds and perspective and use all of the tools rather than just one tool.
I can imagine sometimes you'll get patients who are just really emotional when they hear no, because they may put a lot of emphasis on ketamine, like this is the holy grail. If I have this, my life's gonna be perfect, right?
Yeah, but once I talk with them and I say, oh yeah, it may not be a good fit for you. Maybe they have a history of schizophrenia, for example, or they have a history of severe, cardiac disease, and there's various contraindications. It's like, yeah, it's just not safe for you, right? We don't want to take that risk, because at the end of the day, as a physician, the first thing for me is do no harm, primum non nocere, which is what we're taught, like, first do no harm. And I don't want to harm people. And so yeah, we frequently say, no, it's not a good fit for you. And there's more options, like, don't lose hope. There's more science, there's more evidence, there's more research. So don't lose hope, because there's more options available now and coming up in the future.
So now I got a more broader question about the future of ketamine-assisted therapy. What do you think are some of the barriers keeping it from getting where it needs to be, like a bigger treatment, a more popular treatment, et cetera?
I would say the biggest challenge right now is insurance coverage, right? Because it's considered off-label use. So, as I'd mentioned, it was FDA approved for use in the operating room and the emergency room for procedural sedation. So that is approved. But if someone is using it off-label, then sometimes that doesn't get approved. And so a lot of insurance companies say, you know what? That's not FDA approved for that indication, so we're not going to cover it. And that can be challenging. Now, I will say it is changing. So, for example, there's a medication, it's called Spravato, which is intranasal esketamine. And so that one is FDA approved. And it's not as robust as IV ketamine, according to some meta-analyses and systematic reviews, but it's still another option where they can get Spravato, intranasal esketamine. And then, interestingly, some insurance companies are saying, you know what, maybe we should cover IV ketamine therapy, because Spravato, because it is branded and it has patent protection, it's quite expensive. And so from the insurance company, they're like, well, we could just use the generic drug and it's going to be the same price and get better results. So I feel like there's a shift that's occurring. I believe the there was a recent article that just came out from the VA slash DOD, Department of Defense, where they now include IV ketamine therapy as an option for treatment-resistant depression. So things are changing for sure.
And for things to make bigger strides as it comes to changes, there just need to be more research, more positive research to change FDA's mind.
I feel like the research is there. So that would be one factor. But I mean, globally, the things that change people's minds are stories, right? So the data is one thing. So there's this old saying, like, people make decisions based upon their emotions and justify it with logic. So I don't know if you've ever heard of this. So I think if there's more stories and more patients saying, hey, this has been effective for me, and maybe even personally talking to their congresswoman or congressman and saying, hey, can you help with us, by telling these stories, about their personal experiences of what they've, suffered with and how it's helped them, I think that would be one significant piece. And then, yeah, I would say just the thing, it's going to take time. It's going to take time. And I think the evidence and the science is one part of it, but then I think kind of the marketing side of, like, storytelling will also be beneficial.
Well, and I got another more uplifting question too. I'm sure you have stories. Like, what are some of your greatest stories about, like, maybe seeing like how happy your patients are from their experience, the joyful moments in your life when you're given these treatments.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many. One patient that stands out more recently was suffering from PTSD, complex PTSD, and she had tried, you know, everything, yoga, meds, etc., therapy, and she still wasn't. She was getting a little bit of relief, but not a significant amount of relief. And she came and saw us, and had her infusions, and you know, with each infusion that the patient gets, we're monitoring their score. So they're filling out the depression score or the PTSD score, or the anxiety score, et cetera. So I remember just seeing her numbers just get significantly better. And it was like, wow, this is getting amazing. And it's just getting better, better, better. We did a 1 month follow-up and she's like, hey, I'm still doing great. She did have one scheduled, but she's like, I'm still doing great. Let's, you know, do 2 months from now. And so it's just quite remarkable how for some patients where they've tried so many things, X, Y, Z, and D, and then it's not working, and then they'll get the ketamine therapy, and having that robust effect is, that's really what makes this job worthwhile for me.
Yeah, just me working with clients in treatment centers who've been to, like, let's say 25 treatment centers to get off their addiction. I'm sure you have a lot of experiences like that too, where you have these clients who are just exhausted. These patients are just tired. They tried everything from like antidepressants, yoga, like you said. They're just looking for that thing that works because they tried and suffered for so many years.
Yeah, that's fascinating with like the addiction, because I don't know if you've ever heard of an author named Gabor Maté.
A little bit I've heard of him.
Yeah, he has some really interesting ideas about addiction and how the addiction starts from typically trauma or something that happened as a childhood. And so the addiction is actually more self-medicating rather than the substance itself. So I think one of the things that can be helpful is getting to those root issues at the core rather than dealing with, you know, kind of the superficial stuff. So, I'm just open-minded to a lot of different approaches, and ketamine therapy is just one of those approaches for sure.
Well, again, like you mentioned, like for the phase three, that's where that trauma lens comes in handy. When, again, you're in that state of mind with the IV in the euphoric phase, you're more likely to get more in tune to that root trauma. When you're in that state of mind, you're more comfortable feeling those harmful experiences that you've always struggled with in the past to deal with those moments.
Yeah, I remember one patient where he was able to like relive the traumatic experience, but not personally experiencing it. So he was able to like see it, but from a third party kind of floating from the top objective. And when he was able to see that traumatic event from a different lens, it changed for him.
Yes.
And he's like, wow. And because ketamine is a dissociative, it disconnects the mind and the body. And so if the person was like personally reliving it, that can be really challenging. But if they're kind of in this protected space where they're not in it, but seeing it from that third party, that can be really useful.
Oh yeah. It's a beautiful thing, man. It really is. Oh yeah. Yep. That's what fascinates me. That's why I want to get more into like trained in psychedelics and ketamine therapy too. It's a passion of mine, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of different, we can talk offline. I can send you some options for different trainings. Cause there's definitely a lot of trainings that are offered. And then I feel like, you know, there's like MAPS with MDMA, there's psilocybin studies, there's DMT studies. So I'm really like, you know, I'm a scientist, I'm a doctor and I'm a scientist, and also practice like in a holistic way. So I like looking at data, and, you know, the data is promising. Mm-hmm. And I think these are going to be coming down the pipeline and more available to our society at large.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I just like a month ago, whatever, I had this random woman try to Facebook me about like psychedelics and stuff. And again, I'm not a doctor, and this random woman's messaging me. I think she saw my podcast. She's like, I really need help. I need to try psychedelics, but I tried MDMA and that doesn't work. What should I do? And I'm like, I'm not a doctor. I'm sorry. Like, go to your doctor and talk to him. I can't help you. You know, and I felt helpless, but it's just like, I'm not going to tell you to try something and I don't know how it's going to affect you.
Yeah,
know?
Definitely don't do that, Jacob. I feel like, you know, in a situation like that where someone has tried, you know, various psychedelic substances, they really need to get in touch with a trained healthcare professional And, you know, we're in California, so obviously not people are going to come, you know, we have had people come from all over, but a couple of resources. The first one I can think of is the ASKP.org would be a good place to start, specifically for ketamine therapy. And that stands for the American Society of Ketamine Physicians, Psychotherapists, and Practitioners. So it's actually ASKP.org. And maybe you can pop this into the show notes later.
Yeah.
That has a listing of ketamine clinics where people can connect with. But yeah, so there's definitely options out there. And I think it's important for people to just keep their mind open and not lose hope.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for being on my show. And as a practitioner, professional as yourself, I just have to ask you, what are your future goals, let's say, in the next 5 years? Do you want to open up another facility, do a book? What's on your mind?
great question. So I'm juggling many, many things right now.
Okay.
With the online course, with the ketamine clinic in Palm Springs, helping other physicians, et cetera. But yeah, I've been thinking about a book actually, because nice. I'm really fascinated about this topic, but it's just like making time. We also had a daughter.
Oh, congratulations.
Pandemic. Yeah. Thanks. So she's about to be 3 years old. And so it's like, you know, finding that work life balance,
mm-hmm.
because at the end of the day, you know, for me, what's really important is just to be healthy, to have, to be the best version of myself, to, you know, get my sleep, get my exercise, yeah. eat healthy, et cetera, so that I can, you know, not be burned out, so that I can actually make a significant impact. But 5 years, yeah, it'd be great to maybe open up, more ketamine clinics. But the other thing that's been really rewarding for me is helping other doctors, open up their ketamine clinics as well, because, you know, it's about leverage. And for me, as a one-on-one, like there's a limited amount of, you know, time I have, but if I can train other people, then those people can help impact others. So I remember like listening to a podcast, they were saying, you know, what's the new definition of a billionaire? And that new definition of a billionaire is not necessarily making $1 billion, but impacting 1 billion lives.
Yeah.
So the question is, how can I impact 1 billion lives? How can I make a bigger impact? Yeah. And so my five-year goal would be that, like making a bigger impact in our world.
Well, man, you have my support, man. I hope you accomplish all that and more. And another thing, if any of my listeners do want to get a hold of you, is there a particular website or email they could use to make contact with you?
Yeah. So they can go to our website, resetketamine.com. It's resetketamine.com. So we're based in Palm Springs, California. So for those people who are local or in California, that would be probably the best. And then for clinicians, doctors in particular who are interested, they could check out ketaminestartup.com, ketamine.com. And then also we are active on all the various social media platforms. So Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn. So just, you know, type in Reset Ketamine or Ketamine Startup and we should pop up.
Well, excellent. Excellent. Well, again, man, Sam, thank you so much for being on the show, man. It was really awesome having you on.
Likewise. It was a blast. Thanks for the work you're doing, Jacob. Really appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to seeing where you go with this, because this is a really cool platform. And I personally listen to a lot of podcasts. And, you know, it was interesting when before I hopped on, I was like listening to your first one.
Okay. My very, very first one or my
very,
first
very, your very, oh, your God. Very, very first one.
I actually did that a couple of days ago and I'm like, oh God, I've changed.
So that's fascinating. I listened to the very, very first one. And then I listened to the more recent one. I think you were interviewing, torontopsychedelics.ca. I forget.
Ronan Levy.
Yep.
I think. No. More, it was a woman. Okay.
There was a woman from Peru. Yep. So I was like listening to both. Or not, you know, simultaneously, but just comparing, like you've come a really long way compared to the first one. So that's awesome. Yeah. I would highly encourage you to do it and continue to do it because, you're definitely improving.
Well, thank you, man. I greatly appreciate it. And let's keep in touch for sure.
Absolutely, Jacob.
I just want to thank Sam for another awesome and amazing behavioral health integration episode. He was an awesome guest. I also want to thank all of my fans for being very supportive. And I just want to let everyone know that the next episode will be about men's mental health advocacy. And that will be aired sometime early next week. I also want to give a shout out to my sponsor, Call Me Go. This is a breathing regulation device meant to help anyone dealing with any type of stress or anxiety. And it helps manage your breathing patterns as you inhale and exhale. I will put the link to that on my show notes. And if you type in BHA podcast as a discount code, you get $30 off the Come and Go device, which is an amazing deal for what you get. I also want to inform everyone that if you do want to get a hold of me personally, my email address is behavioralhealthintegration121@gmail.com. I am also on LinkedIn, and I have a website, behavioralhealthintegration.org. And please, if you have time, feel free to add a review for my podcast. I would love to hear from you. And again, thank you everyone for your support. I also want to inform everyone that the information expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a medical doctor or a licensed mental health professional. And until next time, have a good day. Bye.